I think it also comes down to what you're providing as a lawyer. If you're providing guidance and counsel and, you know, advice, I don't think that's going to be outsourced by technology anytime soon, if at all. I think it becomes more tricky when you're talking about, say, a law firm practice that really relies on copying and pasting, like just stuff like that. And if you look at the history of technology and law, emails, faxes, they all came into play and they didn't take away law jobs. In fact, I think part of that drove more demand for legal services. So technology generally is the same thing. I don't think it'll take away jobs. I do think it'll create new winners and new losers. And that maybe is what people feel a little bit worried about. But for the most part, I think the job of a lawyer isn't going anywhere anytime soon. You're not going to have a computer provide expert legal counsel.
Welcome to How I Lawyer, a podcast where I talk to attorneys from throughout the profession about what they do, why they do it, and how they do it well. I'm your host, Jonah Perlin, a law professor in Washington, D.C. Now let's get started.
Hello and welcome back. In today's episode, I'm very excited to speak with Alex Sue. Alex is currently the head of community development at Ironclad, a digital contract management company. Before Ironclad, Alex was a sales team lead and director of business development at other legal tech startups. And before transitioning to the world of legal tech, he was an associate at the New York law firm Sullivan & Cromwell and a law clerk in Chicago and a federal district court judge, Edmund Chang. In addition to Alex's work in legal tech, he's perhaps most well known on TikTok, where you can find him at Legal Tech Bro, where his comedic videos about the legal industry get an incredible 3 to 4 million monthly views. He's a graduate of Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law, go Wildcats, and Carnegie Mellon, go Tartans. Welcome to the podcast, Alex.
Thanks so much for having me, Jonah. I'm really excited to be here.
I'd just love to start by talking a little bit about your work in the sort of legal tech space and your current role as head of community at a company called Ironclad. That's not a common title for lawyers. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit about what you do at Ironclad and what your day-to-day life is like.
Yeah, it's really not a common role. And I'll walk you through my career path because I think there's a story behind it that explains how I ended up where I am. When I started off in legal tech, I joined the sales team, and a big part of being on a sales team is that you have to generate new conversations with lawyers for sales purposes. And it can be hard making cold calls or sending cold emails. But what I found was that I started putting out social media content, especially on LinkedIn, where I would talk about being a lawyer, leaving the practice of law. And that would generate a lot of interest and have inbound inquiries in my DMs where people would start asking me, hey, how do I get a demo of your product? So this was going on for probably a few years. And so I grew in my sales career, in my legal tech sales career. And it wasn't until about 6 months ago when I started talking to Ironclad and they said, hey, we're trying to create this community function. It's new. It's not a known function in many companies, although it is a growing discipline within legal tech and within tech generally. Essentially what it is we want to, instead of doing traditional sales and marketing, we want to engage with the community that uses our product. And Ironclad product is contract management, which is used primarily by in-house legal departments. So they wanted to start engaging in conversations, creating a forum, creating events, community, and engaging with a broader community outside of Ironclad customers on social media. So what I do on a day-to-day basis now, my role really is really just driving engagement among our community members. That can include legal operations professionals, in-house lawyers, but really anybody who touches on contracts. And I know that's a vague, amorphous job description, but that's what it's like in tech. You sometimes got to take on roles that have multiple different functions, and your job changes every month, every quarter, sometimes every week.
Yeah. And is this sort of a move that you see legal tech making more broadly and less sort of traditional sales model and more towards what at least as a consumer I've seen outside of the legal world, which is build community and following first and paying customers come later? Is that sort of a model that you think is going to take over in the legal tech space, or are we going to, like everything else with law, be a little bit further behind?
I do think it will take over because I think also legal is a very unique segment. If you look at other industries, like if you look at marketing, they're used to receiving cold calls, they're used to receiving cold emails and buying software off of that. But lawyers don't do it that way. I thought it was interesting. My job once upon a time was to be a salesperson, cold calling lawyers. But I remembered also, like when I was a lawyer, I never took any cold calls. That's just not the right way to market to me. I don't know about you,
right,
Jonah, same here. You take cold calls. And so I think in legal, there's an opportunity to create a community and create conversations and host conversations among the people you're trying to sell to without pushing it on them and just being there. And over time, they will raise their hands and say, I'm interested in taking a look, especially if they hear other community members raving about the product, which is, I think, the move. There's a trend towards this in tech, but especially true in legal.
And I guess maybe taking a step back, just talking a little bit about like legal tech more broadly from the outside and someone who's not part of this world at all. I'm an academic now, so I'm really not part of this world at all. But even as an associate at a big law firm, I used whatever technology was provided to me by and large. And I think that's true for a lot of sort of big law and more junior lawyers. Like, it feels like this space is just growing gangbusters. There's like new products all the time that do to varying degrees, sometimes the exact same thing as the other products that already exist. What are somebody from the inside, what are we missing about legal tech, or what are the things that we're that are undervalued or not talked about that are the next step of this space?
I think that historically legal has been a step behind other industries when it comes to leveraging technology. There's a few reasons why, and a lot of people speculate on about it on Twitter. A couple of ideas include stereotypes about lawyers being late adopters of technology, but also legal is very interesting that it's a regulated space where only certain types of people, people who pass the bar who are licensed, can do provide services and work to other people. And so historically, law has been insulated from a lot of technological change.
Sure.
I think that's changed over the last 5 years. And I'm lucky enough to have a front row seat to that because I joined legal tech 5 years ago. But a couple of trends that have happened in our space is that number one, legal buyers, and right now mainly we'll call it enterprise or large corporate legal departments, those folks are starting to put a magnifying glass to how outside legal spend is being allocated. Like, how are you hiring law firms to do the work? Is there a provider that we can use to do work more cost effectively? And so you're seeing the sprouting up of all of these smaller organizations. It started off with outsourcing, but then it started moving to legal tech where technology can automate a lot of these simpler tasks. And especially if you have law firms using technology as well, they can differentiate themselves to their clients. So there's a combination of multiple trends that are happening that have caused new legal tech companies to sprout up left and right, especially when you see a little bit older legal tech companies like that are 5 or 10 years old, really starting to succeed in the marketplace. So that encourages newer entrants to come in and start their own companies.
And I guess my other question to follow up on that is there's always this concern, I think, that lawyers are going to put themselves out of business, or outside counsel is going to no longer be as valuable to in-house counsel if they have tools available to them. But I've had other people on the podcast talk a little bit about how as law changes, the only way we can keep up and do our new job is technology. So how do you respond to the old school view that if we adopt technology too quickly, we're going to put ourselves out of business?
I think it also comes down to what you're providing as a lawyer. If you're providing guidance and counsel and, you know, advice, I don't think that's going to be outsourced by technology anytime soon, if at all. I think it comes into, it becomes more tricky when you're talking about, say, a law firm practice that really relies on copying and pasting, like just stuff like that. And if you look at the history of technology and law, emails, faxes, they all came into play and they didn't take away law jobs. In fact, they, I think part of that drove more demand for legal services. So technology generally is the same thing. I don't think it'll take away jobs. I do think it'll create new winners and new losers. And that maybe is what people feel a little bit worried about. But for the most part, I think the job of a lawyer isn't going anywhere anytime soon. You're not going to have a computer provide expert legal counsel.
Not yet, at least. Yeah. So I'd love, we'll come back to the sort of legal tech piece in a little bit, but I'd love to talk a little bit about your personal path to legal tech. You had a pretty traditional resume, as I started the episode with, Northwestern Law Review, federal clerkship, big corporate law firm in New York. What was the reason you decided to pivot, or maybe even more specifically, what was that moment when you were a big law lawyer where you're like, I need to do something different and it's going to be tech?
It wasn't, I've never been a tech person. So this wasn't part of the plan. When I was in law school, like many others, I was like, oh, I got to be successful. What's the formula? What's the playbook? it's make law review, get a federal clerkship if you want to be a litigator. I think you and I were talking before we recorded. I wanted to be an AUSA, and it was a pretty standard path. You just got to get the clerkship, got to work for a certain firm, and then get the job as an AUSA. So I embarked on that path. And then when I got into practice, I remember thinking to myself, I'm working on this privilege log, and we're talking about the formatting, like what words should be used to describe what's in the privilege communications. And this is my job now. Mm-hmm. And I remember hopping on a conference call with a client where the partner was on the call too. And they were talking about the same thing. They were talking about the formatting, like how the Excel spreadsheet should look. And I was like, this is a guy who has a stronger resume than me, is a partner at a big law firm, and he's doing this stuff. I don't think you can escape it. I think that's just, and that was the moment I thought maybe the decisions I made on my career choices that were made from the outside looking in when I was, you know, 19 or 20 years old, or in law school, but 23, 24 years old, maybe I need to make an update. Maybe I need to do something different. That was probably the first time, that privilege log conference call. And then I didn't immediately leave law. I tried a couple of different things after that. I left Sullivan and Cromwell to join a plaintiff side firm. That was a move I made from New York. I moved to California. I started to see how this plaintiff side firm used technology to really have one or two lawyers go up against 20 lawyer teams from big law. And I was like, this technology thing, it's really changing the balance of power here. And I was in the Bay Area. I knew that tech was big here in California. And so I started paying attention to that space. That plaintiff's firm that job didn't work out for me. And I even tried starting my own solo practice right after that. That didn't work out either. So I tried a bunch of things in law, and I was like, all right, I don't think these things are working out for me. Let me try something completely different. And that's when I applied for a job at an early stage legal tech startup in eDiscovery. I applied for a job called an SDR job, a sales development representative. That's like a entry level salesperson that typically the profile of that someone in that role is like a new college grad, never had a job before, just making cold calls day in, day out. And I was like, I think with my legal experience and, you know, my ability to work with people, I feel like I could do well at this job, but I have no idea, but I'll just go and do it. And so I just jumped 6 years after law school. And yeah, it's been a wild ride since.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is really important is every new lawyer, and I get to see a lot of them in my current job, just working with law students, has that moment of, is this what I want to be doing for the rest of my life? And often the answer is, that's not what you're going to be doing for the rest of your life. That's what you're doing now, so you can do something else later on. But I think it's a really, really important skill to look at the people who have reached the pinnacle in your organization. And if what they're doing is not what you want to do long-term, then you're in the wrong place. And start looking tomorrow, because that's not going to change. And so I think that's really, really fascinating sort of way of mental model for thinking about junior lawyering. The other thing that's amazing is your willingness to just try things. I mean, this podcast is a testament to the idea that lawyers can do almost anything, but we got to try a bunch of things. I guess my follow-up to that is, was it a really big challenge going from Sullivan and Cromwell and the federal judiciary to like, like sales rep? Like, how did other lawyers, how did your family react? Like, how did you deal with that big shift in, for lack of a better word, prestige?
It was tough in the beginning. When you have a job at a fancy place, you start to tie up your identity in it. And I think that took a few years to unravel. My friends and my family all understood, because once I got into to SNC, it was very interesting what happened. All my friends, all my peers at SNC, there was a lot of like gallows humor. Like when people left, like someone left the firm, we would all look at each other and be like, oh, they made it out. Yeah, they did it. We could do it one day too. It was so different. Meanwhile, I had spent so many years like dreaming of working for a firm like that. And so leaving that, I think it was hard to do at first, but when I tried something different and I tried something different again, each time I came away knowing something, and I was like, it's okay if I mess up at my next thing, but I can't make the same mistake twice, which is why I didn't go to like, I remember when I moved to the West Coast, I was thinking maybe I should join another big law firm out on the West Coast. But I was like, no, I can't do that because time is more important to me than prestige, because I had been in a prestige job and it wasn't what I wanted to do. It was just not for me. So I think it was hard, but at the same time, I collected enough experiences to know that I knew what to avoid. And I think chasing prestige and short-term money, and what I mean by short-term money is big salaries, even though I think big law salaries have gone up since I left. So it's probably harder to turn down. I think for anyone listening, those two things, money and prestige, they can be traps. So that's what, you know, it took a while for me to walk away from, but I also had the support of my friends and family, and that made it easier.
Yeah. And that's always the challenge when you're making these moves. And again, I couldn't agree more that sometimes having a job tells you what you don't want to do more than what you want to do. And right, it's okay if you get it wrong once. If you get it wrong twice, that's on you. And so it seems like that was your approach as well. Learn from the prior and then try to do the next thing.
It really was. And when I talk about my path today, it does seem a bit engineered, like I had planned this grand path, but really what it was just going from failure to failure. But each time learning something a little bit more about myself and the world and then where I fit in. Like when I left my clerkship, I actually went to join a political campaign. And I'd done political campaigns during law school and just a passion of mine, just getting involved with just local politics. Not from a policy perspective, but maybe more from a like retail politics, you know, mm-hmm. calling people, knocking on doors. And so I did that kind of stuff, that kind of work all along the way. And I learned that I'm actually quite good at cold calling. And now this is like a very unique thing because everyone hates cold calling. Right. If you've ever had a cold calling job, you're like, it's a pretty terrible job. But I actually had fun with it. And my personality, I could do well with it. So by the time many years later, when I made the jump to that entry-level sales job in legal tech, it wasn't a completely crazy move. It was along the lines of, I knew that I could do well at that job, or I had a hunch I would do well at that job because I was good at calling. I knew enough about the legal space. I had used e-discovery software. So there were all these factors that were in play for me. But it was very humbling to go into work with a bunch of 22-year-olds who like didn't know the difference between litigation and transactional work. Right. Meanwhile, like I'm calling people up, calling up lawyers and saying, hey, do you want to see a product demo of this software? It was very humbling.
Sure. Yeah. And again, that's another thing that I like to highlight, but I think you highlighted even better in your own life, is this idea that your outside skills, the things you're good at, don't necessarily change because you happen to get a law degree. And if you can find ways to like use those skills and stay away from the things you don't like or are not so good at, that can make you have a much more fulfilling career and find it. I guess that does lead to my next question though about skills. How did you, sometimes I see the word upskill, like how did you upskill in sales and management and business and marketing and all these skills that you needed to make a quick move in your industry that were different than the skills that you had been building and flexing in the law?
I think that I did not have a plan to upskill going into it. The thing about the startup world that's different than law is that I think law really relies on formal training or maybe some informal training through mentorship, but really teaching you how to do things. In startups, you just get out there and do it and mess up and then learn from there. I learned better that way. And so when I went into this entry-level sales job, I just tried to do a really good job at what I did. And in startups, there's always more work that needs to be done. So I did my job. There was more work that needed to be done. I started doing that stuff. It started being more higher level work. I did it. I messed up, but the company was growing and I rode the wave upwards. And so I think that's what makes startups and tech startups in particular different than the law, where at law, I feel like in many spaces within the law, there's not as much growth. You've got to wait your turn. You got to really be super prepared before you take the next level. Whereas in startups, they're always looking for good people to do work. And so I did that for 5 years. I was in sales. I went from being an entry-level salesperson who made cold calls to set appointments. I started closing smaller deals. Remember, when I say closing, I was responsible for the entire sales conversation and convincing someone to buy and sign on the dotted line. I started handling bigger and bigger accounts. And it got to the point where 5 years out, 5 years into legal tech, I'm in this space where it's completely new, this intersection between social media and community. I had to learn how to make memes. I had to learn all of these things that I never imagined I'd be doing, and no one's taught me anything, but you figure your way out. And then occasionally people will give you some guidance. So that's how I would say I upskilled. Probably not a hugely satisfying answer, but that's how I learned it.
No. And do you ever find yourself relying on any of those legal skills that you built over all those years, even if informally or in a little bit of a different way?
At first, I thought I didn't, but looking back and hearing what other people say to me, I have, because there are these core skills that you get as a lawyer that you don't realize you are exercising until you leave and you start seeing how other people do things. So for example, I never thought of myself as an effortless writer, but sometimes I can, you know, when I'm asked to put together a memo or describe something, I just do it very quickly compared to other people. My written work is very organized. I use a lot of bullet points and I use like introductory sentences. And so you can only, if you read it, like the first sentence of each of my paragraphs, you can get the point. I do these things by habit. I didn't realize I was doing them, but people were telling me that I was. So I think that the core legal training that you get as a written communicator, for example, that sticks with you and that has value.
And I guess maybe there's somebody out there listening who's thinking like, this sounds a lot like me. Like I'm a lawyer, I'm trained as a lawyer, but some of what Alex is talking about sounds more like the things like I enjoy. And I'll tell you, I posted on social media right before this to get some questions from the world. And I got probably more interaction on that tweet than I do from any other sort of what questions should I ask tweet, which says to me, there's interest out there. What should someone look in the mirror and see and say, this might be a good fit for you? Or by contrast, what might they look in the mirror and see and legal tech might not be a great pivot for them?
I think that you got to start from kind of first principles. And there's two things you would want to think about. Number one, what am I good at? What am I bad at? Everyone has a superpower. And I think that you could have, and we could talk about legal tech and sales, but if you're a good seller, if you're naturally good at selling, you don't have to go to legal tech. You can be a recruiter. You can do a lot of different things. I think many people on the outside fixate on the industry, but I think the function is more important. And so you got to line up your strengths and weaknesses with the function. Sometimes I look back and I'm like, hey, knowing that I was good at sales, maybe I should not have done this path. Maybe I should have just gone to a smaller firm and tried to become a rainmaker. Like that could have been a good path for me.
Sell business.
Exactly. So I think knowing what you're good at and what you're bad at, that is so underrated. And that's something that I'm constantly trying to figure out. I think it's something that people need to learn over time in their entire lives and then make a decision on that. And that brings me to my second point, which is once you know what you're good at and bad at and where you might fit in, like you got to make a move. The reason why I think that post was so popular, the reason why whenever I post on LinkedIn about how I made my move to leave the practice of law, so many lawyers are hesitant to make that first jump. They want to research it. They want to understand all of the risks and possibilities, and then they make the move. But often they end up not making the move at all and just staying unhappy at their jobs. And so that's why I think it's popular. I've found that whenever I put out content related to my move out of law, people are just very curious about it. And I wish I had a really good answer, like here's the playbook, here's the formula. But really it was just a series of making mistakes, learning more about what you're good at and bad at, and then taking a bet by moving quickly into a job that you think you might be good at.
Yeah, I think that's true. That's true for my own life, becoming an academic. I didn't think I was a bad lawyer, but I didn't love what I was doing every day. I got into a classroom once, I adjuncted a class, and I said, man, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And then I tried to figure out ways to do it. And that helps so much. I think there's this, and maybe social media doesn't help with this and LinkedIn doesn't help with this. Everything looks so linear, right? Like you did this and then you did this. It looks like it was planned from the beginning. It only looks planned from the end.
It does. It really does. And that is, I think, partly due to social media, but social media is amplifying what people have always said, which is if you do A, B, and C, you'll be fine. And this goes beyond law. Go to a good college. You'll have your future will be set. Buy a house early on in your life, and then you'll be financially set. And there's just all these formulas that people tell each other, when in reality, the world is a lot more chaotic and trial and error seems to work a lot better than having this grand plan.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about your videos and your memes and your social media, but before we get there, I always like to focus on one skill in these interviews. And usually I figure out what that skill is in advance, but the skill you've brought up a couple times is being good at cold calling. And so I'd love for you to just talk, maybe it's just natural for you, but talk a little bit about how you can develop that skill or some one or two tips or techniques for those of us that hate picking up the phone like me, but need to do it and often need to sell something.
Yeah. So there's a few concepts that are important to know when you make a cold call. The first is you're not trying to sell anything all in one sentence, all in one go. You want to earn the right for 5 more seconds on the call. Everything that you do has to be broken down. So when you're calling, maybe you should ask them for time first. They're saying, okay, they have time. And then you make a one sentence pitch that tries to get them to be curious enough to stay a little bit longer. And so when you make this, when you kind of string it all together, it looks like one seamless pitch, but it's really a series of little pitches. So that's the first thing I would say. And then the second thing is knowing how to articulate your value proposition in a very succinct sentence. If I were selling technology, like for example, Ironclad's technology, I wouldn't give you all of the features and all the benefits that it has. I would say, this is technology that helps in-house counsel approve sales contracts super quickly. It's oversimplified in a generalization, but it might prompt them to say, okay, how do you do that? Then you've earned their next 5 seconds. So breaking it down and then articulating it in one sentence and then earning more time, that is the secret to cold calling. And I think just as I'm telling you this, you can probably imagine how that skill translates to creating compelling content on social media. Because each sentence that you write, whether it's a tweet, a LinkedIn post, or even a TikTok video, every bit that you're putting out there, you are trying to earn a little bit more time with the audience. And you have to get your point across very quickly and easily in those few seconds.
Does that change? So many lawyers now communicate either predominantly or even exclusively by email. And email's the worst at having small gate. You get your subject line and you get your first paragraph, but it's not the same. Is there a problem as we move to email, we're losing this art of the progressive conversation that you're building?
I think so. I think, and this is probably not just for lawyers, but probably does afflict a lot of lawyers because you want to be as complete as possible. But being complete as possible is often a reflection of what you as the writer want. It's not a reflection of what the reader wants. The reader just wants to know the main takeaways. And maybe if they want to know more, they can send a follow-up and say, can you tell me more about point three? Like, I'd like to learn more about that. But emails, when you're doing an email, it's very easy to just give them all of your research and then all of the answers so that you feel like complete and you feel like you've done your job. So I never thought about it that way, but I think that's absolutely right. I think that email does play a role in this.
Since you've just entered my world and talked about legal writing and audience, which I absolutely love, I want to talk about your world. So tell me about how this TikTok thing happened, started, and what it's like to create content for lawyers on, at least from my perspective, the bleeding edge of social media and communication. I'm sure it's not, but it feels like the bleeding edge to me.
Yeah, I never imagined that I would be on TikTok. I heard about TikTok a while ago and I was like, oh, it's like an app for dancing teenagers. It's not for me. I'm a LinkedIn guy. I'm a writer. I'm going to write a short form post for my lawyer people. It's going to be great. But when the pandemic hit, I tried a lot of different things. And this goes back to the general theme of trying different things and figuring out what works. I hosted meetups. I posted weird posts. I just wrote all these things and I wanted to see what resonated with people. One of the things I tried that really resonated with people was I recorded a 30-second short form video clip skit of me reenacting something from my past experience working in law. I used Zoom to record it. I used iMovie on Mac to edit it. It took forever, but I put it up on LinkedIn and people absolutely loved it. And I put out another one and then I put out a third one and people started telling me, you need to get on TikTok, Alex. And I was like, I don't really want to do TikTok. It's for dancing teenagers. But over time, I realized like, maybe I should listen to them. These people are asking for it. So I'll go on TikTok because editing on iMovie takes forever. It's really hard. And I went on TikTok. I remember the first time I used the editing tools on my phone. It was great. It was super efficient. And I was like, I'll create the videos here. I have no followers on TikTok. It's probably a bunch of kids. I'll download it out and put it on LinkedIn, which is what I did. I did that for a few videos. And on my fourth video on TikTok, it went massively viral, 2 million views. Wow. And overnight, I had thousands of followers. And I was like, I can't believe this is happening. like, this is not in the plan, but I'll lean into it because it's the world is telling me something again. So I started making more videos. I started building up an audience. I started posting them on different platforms. Remember, this was like less than a year ago. So this is pretty new to me.
Right.
And so I went on TikTok for a few months, posting it on LinkedIn. I started Instagram earlier in 2021. I posted it there. People started seeing it there. And then I really started getting on Twitter probably about 3 or 4 months ago. And so it's all new to me, but creating this content really, I think you really do have to listen to the world telling you whether it's your audience or the people you work with. People can sometimes see things that you can't yourself see about yourself. It's a good way to tell you what you're good at, what you should be focused on. And so I'm glad I listened to those people when they told me you should get on TikTok, because they saw something in me that I didn't see. I saw myself as a serious lawyer who shared my thoughts through the written word, but they saw something with more potential in the videos.
And do you think there are benefits? You've just stated some of them, but to the sort of average lawyer or even law student or sort of junior lawyer to put themselves out there, maybe not necessarily doing like hilarious videos on TikTok, but just putting themselves out there in social media. And are there detriments to that as well? Like, how do you think about, I'm sure now that you're like internet law famous, I'm sure people ask you, what should I be doing? What kind of advice would you give someone like that?
I think that you do have to have some participation in social media, especially around the professional networks like LinkedIn. I think a lot of other platforms may or may not be good for you from a professional perspective. But if you are going to put yourself out there, I think you have to, number one, figure out what your medium is. Some people come across on videos better than in the written word. Some people come across better in audio. So they're podcast people. So everyone has a right to their primary medium. And so you got to find that. And then in terms of the content, you have to say things or write things or put stuff out there that's authentic to you. Like, I think that sometimes people might see what I'm doing and say, hey, that seems to be working well. Let me try to copy that. That would be a mistake, because what I'm putting out is really genuine to me and who I am. Like, my friends know that who I am, and this is consistent with my personality. But if I put out stuff that wasn't consistent with my personality, I think that would not land well. So for those people who are thinking about doing it, figure out what your right medium is. And if you're going to participate, do something that's authentic to you. Tell your own story. It doesn't have to be your career story. It could be other things. It doesn't have to be like memes and making fun of the legal profession, which is what I do. It could be just asking people questions, putting out thought-provoking questions that you're curious about. So there's a lot of ways to do this. And I think there's no one way to do it.
I guess the follow-up to that, right, is what lawyers, and that's my audience, I'm focused on my audience. I hear a lot of what you're saying and think about the process of starting this podcast. Like, I wasn't even a podcast consumer, better yet, a podcast producer. But I had built a little bit of a following on LinkedIn. I met a lot of cool people, and on Twitter, and I had met a lot of cool people there. And I figured there was this gap, which is my students really wanted to hear from lawyers, not whoever the law school brought them, but real lawyers doing real things about how they did it. And so I just jumped. And you're right, the tech part is hard, right? Like, my first one took me hours to edit, but it's been a way to connect with new people. And it's built me both my personal and professional life and been incredibly fulfilling. So I guess the challenge is balancing that conservative profession, which has always been a little bit guarded, with this more open life. I always fear telling my law students, go out there and put yourself out there, because they don't know what they are yet. And so is there any sort of reason to wait, or is your advice the same? Find a little way and jump in.
I think you got to, if you've decided that this is the path you want to take, if you do want to put yourself out there, I think you got to find a little something and then work your way in, because like I've shared with you the later stages of my journey, but I've always put myself out there sometimes anonymously. I do think that what you're really doing is you're really entering a conversation with members of the legal profession in a virtual way, in an internet way. I think that's always going to be helpful. And you do need to figure out how you're going to network. I think networking is going to have to be a necessary part of being a lawyer just for your entire career. Now, maybe it's in person where you can hold a cocktail at a happy hour and just talk to people about random things like that. Maybe that's your approach, but you can really scale things with things like Twitter, like what you've described on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Like what I see on Twitter, what I think is really interesting is the development of this whole appellate Twitter section where people are not only talking about work, they're talking about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And I think that those connections are creating a lot of value for different people. So by not getting into that conversation, even just saying, hey, I need career advice. I think that's one great approach for a lot of younger law students or younger lawyers. That's one great approach, because what lawyer doesn't want to talk about themselves? Like, that's the whole reason why I'm doing this podcast, Jonah. I love hearing myself talk. So,
and it's amazing how many people are willing to. And as we were talking a little bit about before we started recording, the internet allows this to happen in really sort of mind-blowing ways, and you connect to people who have no geographic similarity to you whatsoever, who you otherwise would not have met, and showed up because the algorithm figured out that you should connect with this person, and there's no niche too small. I guess that was going to be my next question to you is, what is it like to be internet famous? 3 to 4 million views of your videos. And I've watched a bunch of them. I think they're hilarious because a lot of things remind me of my own past, but you're mostly commenting on a pretty niche profession and you're getting 3 to 4 million views. What's it like to be internet famous?
I don't know. It's kind of scary to me because I've been doing this only really during the pandemic and I haven't gone outside really. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I've been doing all this in my bedroom and my home office. Like, I did move from SF to LA recently, but there has not yet been a real life impact to me. And I think that's coming when things reopen and it's probably going to be pretty overwhelming. But I think that over time, I think more of our lives are going to be online. And I think sometimes I have to be careful about what I post too, because I'm like, at first it was just me posting things for fun. Now what I post is associated with my company, mm-hmm. Ironclad. And so I have to be careful too. And so it is a skill, and I don't envy people who are growing up with social media, like in elementary school or junior high. I think just this social media or internet age, like it's just here to stay. Yeah, I don't really know what it's going to be like when I get out there. But for now, I just like, what I really like is I like making people laugh. I like just generating conversations. Like when you put out a funny video, people will start talking about the concept underlying it, especially if it's a serious topic that no one like really wants to talk about, but you make a joke about it. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly everyone comes in and starts sharing their perspective. I really like that. So that's why I'm in a community function. But it's really changed my life. Like it helped me get the job I have now. I love what I do. I can't believe I work with who I work with. Like my boss is a legend in legal operations. Her name's Mary O'Carroll. I've been following her from afar for a long time and like watching her like speak on stage and like just in the legal tech space. She's very well known. And now I work with her all the time. I'm still dealing with understanding, like, this is my life now. A rambling answer to your question.
No, but I mean, I just so appreciate the fact that you start with, I just like to make people laugh. But the conversations that people have in light of that, you're making social commentary and you're opening up a conversation. If you do a meme about, you know, I think I remember you did one about how first year associates talk to paralegals, right? And anybody who's been past a first year associate knows that first year associates are often horrible at talking to paralegals. They tell them what to do. They go on their power trip and everybody from the tippy top partner all the way down to the paralegal always looks at the first year associate and says, huh? Like, why are you talking to him or her or them like that?
Yeah.
But my explanation is nothing compared to you doing a video of it and then having a conversation after it. And so I think you've almost found like an art form that allows us to have important conversations about what it means to be a lawyer and how to do it.
That's the most meaningful part of what I'm doing. I think that I find most interesting. Like, I have been surprised at how candid people are on social media. So part of if you see my content, especially, I roast Big Law a lot. I make fun of Big Law a lot. And a lot of it does come from the energy that comes from associates who are on various social media platforms who feel anonymous. There are some things that are happening in Big Law that shouldn't be happening. And so I start posting about it, like the lack of diversity, the weak partnership prospects, the overwork, the lack of focus on mental health, substance abuse, all these topics, like I joke about it. Mm-hmm. And I think it is actually reaching the leadership at big law firms. I did a podcast maybe 6 months ago with the chairman at Cyfarth. It scared me so much. I was like, he's like talking to me about TikToks. And I'm like, has he seen them? Does he know what I post? But the great thing, the thing that I think is super interesting is that he agreed with a lot of the things. I think he just wasn't in a position to really talk about it. As a leader, you've got to be diplomatic or you can't just put out TikToks roasting the old guard or the dinosaurs at the firm. So I have that ability. I put it out. Big law partners are watching them. They DM me privately on all the platforms, including Twitter. And they're like, you're speaking to something that we're seeing at our firm too. So I do think that is the most meaningful part of me putting out content. At first, it was like just making people laugh, but now I can't believe like the conversations that it's prompting with the types of people in leadership positions in big law firms.
Amazing. Yeah, I think it's so important to start that conversation. And look, we're trying to have that conversation in law schools. We're trying to have that conversation in government. We're trying to have that conversation a lot. And the fact that you help grease the wheels of that conversation really helps. And we're all grateful for it. I always like to end these podcast interviews with sort of a piece of advice, something to take with the listener. And you've given a lot of advice, but I guess I'm particularly curious about some advice you would give to someone who either doesn't know a lot about legal tech or wants to be a part of it or use it. What's a piece of advice of how to use legal tech going forward?
Yeah, if you want to get into the legal tech space, I would say just get in there. Don't overthink it. Don't over-research it, because once you get in, the ground shifts so quickly that you'll stumble into where you belong and grow from there. In terms of using legal tech, I think there's going to be a lot of different new legal tech that's going to come out. Rely on customer recommendations and referrals, because marketing campaigns may sound great. Maybe the salesperson sounds really smooth, but at the end of the day, if the legal tech vendor has made a customer successful, that customer is going to want to tell everyone about it. That is, I think, the best proxy. And that's why we're focused on community at Ironclad, because we want to facilitate those conversations. It's like the superpower of the company. So we're going to lean into it. So that's the advice I would give. And more generally for your law students, the answer isn't about, the approach isn't, oh, should I leave law? Should I go into legal tech? The real thing you should be asking yourself is, what am I good at? What am I bad at? Where is an environment that will reward what I'm good at and where my weaknesses won't matter? I think that's the real thing you want to look for. And I wish I knew that when I was in law school. I just focused on what people were telling me. You got to get a job at these firms. You got to get a clerkship with these judges and these courts, and then you can get that AUSA job. I feel like that was the wrong approach. So I would leave your listeners with that, and obviously caveat everything by saying, I'm not some wise old sage. I'm trying to figure things out as I go along, but I'll pass along what's worked for me.
Amazing. I guess to end, Alex, where can people find you if they haven't already seen you and your various hilarious memes and videos? Where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter, on LinkedIn, and on TikTok. And I'm forgetting all the platforms I'm on. So I think the easiest way to reach me is find my LinkedIn, Alex Sue at Ironclad. And then I have links to my TikToks there. You can find me there, but LinkedIn is probably the best place.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Alex. I really appreciate the conversation and hope we can keep it going in the future. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jonah. This was a lot of fun.